The newspapers did not mention the outbreaks of violence that had begun to burst across the country, but she watched them through the reports of train conductors about bullet-riddled cars, dismantled tracks, attacked trains, besieged stations. In Nebraska, in Oregon, in Texas, in Montana, the futile, doomed outbreaks prompted by nothing but despair, ending in nothing but destruction. Some were the explosions of local gangs, some spread wider. There were districts that rose in blind rebellion, arrested the local officials, expelled the agents of Washington, killed the tax collectors, then announcing their secession from the country, went on to the final extreme of the very evil that had destroyed them, as if fighting murder with suicide. Went on to seize all property within their reach, to declare community bondage of all to all, and to perish within a week, their meager loot consumed in the bloody hatred of all for all, in the chaos of no rule save that of the gun, to perish under the lethargic thrust of a few worn soldiers sent out from Washington to bring order to the ruins. The newspapers did not mention it. The editorials went on speaking of self-denial as the road to future progress, of self-sacrifice as the moral imperative, of greed as the enemy, of love as the solution. Their threadbare phrases as sickeningly sweet as the odor of ether in a hospital. Rumors went spreading through the country in whispers of cynical terror, yet people read the newspapers and acted as if they believed what they read, each competing with the others on who would keep most blindly silent, each pretending that he did not know what he knew, each striving to believe that the unnamed was the unreal. It was as if a volcano were cracking open, yet the people at the foot of the mountain ignored the sudden fissures, the black fumes, the boiling trickles, and went on believing that their only danger was to acknowledge the reality of these signs. Listen to Mr. Thompson's report on the world crisis, November 22nd. It was the first acknowledgement of the unacknowledged. The announcements began to appear a week in advance and went ringing across the country. Mr. Thompson will give the people a report on the world crisis. Listen to Mr. Thompson on every radio station and television channel at 8 p.m. on November 22nd. First, the front pages of the newspapers and the shouts of the radio voices had explained it. To counteract the fears and rumors spread by the enemies of the people, Mr. Thompson will address the country on November 22nd. And will give us a full report on the state of the world in this solemn moment of global crisis. Mr. Thompson will put an end to those sinister forces whose purpose is to keep us in terror and despair. He will bring light into the darkness of the world and will show us the way out of our tragic problems. A stern way, as befits the gravity of this hour, but a way of glory as granted by the rebirth of light. Mr. Thompson's address will be carried by every radio station in this country and in all countries throughout the world, wherever radio waves may still be heard. Then the chorus broke loose and went growing day by day. Listen to Mr. Thompson on November 22nd, said daily headlines. Don't forget Mr. Thompson on November 22nd, cried radio stations at the end of every program. Mr. Thompson will tell you the truth, said placards in subways and buses. Then posters on the walls of buildings. Then billboards on deserted highways. Don't despair, listen to Mr. Thompson, said pennants on government cars. Don't give up, listen to Mr. Thompson, said banners in offices and shops. Have faith, listen to Mr. Thompson, said voices in churches. Mr. Thompson will give you the answer, wrote army airplanes across the sky, the letters dissolving in space, and only the last two words remaining by the time the sentence was completed. Public loudspeakers were built in the squares of New York for the day of the speech, and came to rasping life once an hour in time with the ringing of distant clocks, to send over the worn rattle of the traffic, over the heads of the shabby crowds, the sonorous mechanical cry of an alarm-toned voice. Listen to Mr. Thompson's report on the world crisis, November 22nd. A cry rolling through the frosted air and vanishing among the foggy rooftops, under the blank page of a calendar that bore no date. On the afternoon of November 22nd, James Taggart told Dagny that Mr. Thompson wished to meet her for a conference before the broadcast. In Washington? She asked incredulously, glancing at her watch. Well, I must say that you haven't been reading the newspapers or keeping track of important events. Don't you know that Mr. Thompson is to broadcast from New York? He has come here to confer with the leaders of industry as well as of labor, science, the professions, and the best of the country's leadership in general. He has requested that I bring you to the conference. Where is it to be held? at the broadcasting studio. They don't expect me to speak on the air in support of their policies, do they? Don't worry. They wouldn't let you near a microphone. They just want to hear your opinion, and you can't refuse, not in a national emergency. Not when it's an invitation from Mr. Thompson in person. He spoke impatiently, avoiding her eyes. When is that conference to be held?
At 7:30.
Not much time to give to a conference about a national emergency, is it? Mr. Thompson is a very busy man. Now, please don't argue. Don't start being difficult.
I don't see what you're...
All right, she said indifferently. I'll come. And added, prompted by the kind of feeling that would have made her reluctant to venture without a witness into a conference of gangsters, but I'll bring Eddie Willers along with me. He frowned, considering it for a moment, with a look of annoyance more than anxiety.
Oh, all right, if you wish, he snapped, shrugging.
She came to the broadcasting studio with James Taggart as a policeman at one side of her, and Eddie Willers as a bodyguard at the other. Taggart's face was resentful and tense, Eddie's resigned, yet wondering and curious. A stage set of pasteboard walls had been erected in a corner of the vast, dim space, representing a stiffly traditional suggestion of a cross between a stately drawing room and a modest study. A semicircle of empty armchairs filled the set, suggesting a grouping from a family album, with microphones dangling like bait at the end of long poles extended for fishing among the chairs. The best leadership of the country, that stood about in nervous clusters, had the look of a remnant sale in a bankrupt store. She saw Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, Chick Morrison, Tinky Holloway, Dr. Floyd Ferris, Dr. Simon Pritchett, Ma Chalmers, Fred Kinnon, and a seedy handful of businessmen, among whom the half-scared, half-flattered figure of Mr. Moen of the Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company was, incredibly, intended to represent an industrial tycoon. But the figure that gave her an instant shock was Dr. Robert Statler. She had not known that a face could age so greatly within the brief space of 1 year. The look of timeless energy, of boyish eagerness, was gone, and nothing remained of the face except the lines of contemptuous bitterness. He stood alone, apart from the others, and she saw the moment when his eyes saw her enter. He looked like a man in a whorehouse who had accepted the nature of his surroundings until suddenly caught there by his wife. It was a look of guilt in the process of becoming hatred. Then she saw Robert Stadler, the scientist, turn away as if he had not seen her, as if his refusal to see could wipe a fact out of existence. Mr. Thompson was pacing among the group, snapping at random bystanders in the restless manner of a man of action who feels contempt for the duty of making speeches. He was clutching a sheaf of typewritten pages, as if it were a bundle of old clothing about to be discarded. James Taggart caught him in mid-step to say uncertainly and loudly, "Mr. Thompson, may I present my sister, Miss Stagney Taggart?"
"So nice of you to come, Miss Taggart," said Mr. Thompson, shaking her hand as if she were another voter from back home, whose name he had never heard before. Then he marched briskly off.
"Where's the conference, Jim?" she asked, and glanced at the clock. It was a huge white dial with a black hand, slicing the minutes, like a knife moving toward the hour of 8.
"I can't help it. I don't run this show," he snapped.
Eddie Willers glanced at her with a look of bitterly patient astonishment and stepped closer to her side. A radio receiver was playing a program of military marches broadcast from another studio, half-drowning the fragments of nervous voices, of hastily aimless steps, of screeching machinery being pulled to focus upon the drawing-room set.
"Stay tuned to hear Mr. Thompson report on the world crisis at 8 p.m., cried the martial voice of an announcer from the radio receiver when the hand on the dial reached the hour of 7:45.
"Step on it, boys, step on it," snapped Mr. Thompson, while the radio burst into another march. It was 7:50 when Chick Morrison, the morale conditioner, who seemed to be in charge, cried,
"All right, boys and girls, all right, let's take our places," waving a bunch of notepaper like a baton toward the light-flooded circle of armchairs.
Mr. Thompson thudded down upon the central chair in the manner of grabbing a vacant seat in a subway. Chick Morrison's assistants were herding the crowd toward the circle of light.
"A happy family," Chick Morrison explained. "The country must see us as a big, united, happy..."
"What's the matter with that thing?"
The radio music had gone off abruptly, choking on an odd little gasp of static, cut in the middle of a ringing phrase.
It was 7:51. He shrugged and went on. "Happy family. Hurry up, boys. Take close-ups of Mr. Thompson first."